That's what it means.
That's what it means. Okay, so another language would not threaten the image. But if I'm concerned that he called me ugly or stupid or something like that, if one person calls me stupid, I react. Another person calls me ugly, I might react. So it's not the particular, it's just the fact that the image, it's the, maybe we're saying the same thing and I'm not understanding you. It's the general fact that a word that would threaten this image is articulated, yeah, and I am in reaction to that.
Yeah, it isn't making sense. You say, how can an image be threatened? You see, if we said the television image was threatened and it reacted, you see, you wouldn't believe it, right? You see, is it just an image? I mean, do you mean by an image?
Well, I realize it has, maybe I'm taking too much time.
No, it's important. What do you really mean by an image?
Do you mean an assumption about yourself?
Well, I have a conjured up picture of this person, and I would imagine, and I'm just saying this from assumption, it has a particular neurological setup in my body. I'm just assuming that's just a jump, okay? And someone comes along and says something that's different from what I want this image to be. I don't know where else to go from there.
Yeah, I'm saying, look, if you have an image, it comes from some assumption about yourself, saying, I assume that I am really a good person, beautiful, competent, or whatever, right?
Yes.
And that creates a good feeling in the body, which gradually you get used to, so you don't know it's there, right?
So that's the bodily
image. That's the bodily image of that assumption, right?
Okay. Right? No problem with that.
Right? Mm-hmm. All right. Now then, somebody else, then in that process, you have a concealment of the fact that this image has been produced by an assumption.
Right.
In other words, the brain is also thinking this image was not produced by an assumption, but it is me who feels so good. If you didn't think that way, it would be no use doing it at all, right? Isn't that clear? If you said, I have cooked up this feeling by thinking that I am good.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, gotcha.
So you then have a concealment of the fact that it has been cooked up, right, somehow. And therefore you say the body now feels good and that's good, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now then, but you have a mechanism whereby an assumption can slip over into a feeling while the process is concealed, right? You have set up a mechanism.
Yes.
That mechanism is not restricted to nice assumptions. Any assumption will go through that mill, right?
Of course.
So along comes another assumption. Somebody else has made another assumption about you. You have picked it up, whether you like it or not, and it has slipped through that machine and has produced a bad feeling.
Yes.
So it's the other person's assumption, which has, although you said you didn't, you're not taking it up, you did take it up.
Yes.
And it became part of you, right?
Yes.
Therefore,
okay.
Is that clear?
Yeah. I'm following you.
Yes. So therefore, because we have set up cooked up a process whereby an assumption can slip over into a feeling and be concealed that that's happening, that is a trap, because we think that will work for nice assumptions, but it also works for, for unpleasant assumptions.
Okay, so I say to myself, this assumption came into this body and it's reacting to it. What does that do to the actual physical reaction?
Well, at the moment, nothing. You see, I'm trying to say we're merely sort of getting some understanding of it. You see that?
Oh, okay.
All right, now, since what was that? What?
Could we suspend our polarities? I'm running out of time.
Oh. You see, the point is that there's a process going on there which culture has built up, right? An experience saying that there's a trap there, that we are in the habit of making assumptions about ourselves and then concealing that and getting good feelings out of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or else letting other people make assumptions about us, and it comes through in the same way. If your friend makes the same assumption, saying you're very competent,
mm-hmm,
and it comes through, goes right through the machine and produces a good feeling.
Yeah.
You see, so you have set that up and say, that's nice, because now I have a good, nice source of good feelings. But along comes somebody else who says you're incompetent. That slips through the machine too, and because it's been concealed, you don't see it happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then along comes the bad feeling, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then you say, I would like to separate these bad feelings from the good feelings, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But I can't because the same machine produces both.
Yes.
Right?
I understand that.
Yes. So that's really where the problem is, you see. But then since I've concealed this whole thing, it has concealed itself, therefore I don't even see that all that's happening, and I say I've got a problem to get good feelings and get rid of bad feelings, right?
So what you're saying is that this really has to be seen, what you're talking about, before yeah. anything else can happen. So you have to really see the actuality.
Well, that would be the best thing, to see this actuality, you see.
But that's mental. I mean, it's if there's an insight, but it has to be a lot more than an idea.
Yeah, I mean, an idea is like a map pointing to the country,
right,
you see.
Right.
But then the country has to be seen. Now, you see, you have to see inside of yourself the connection between the thought, and if anybody, see, we have all sorts of assumptions that are getting in the way. One is that this thought belongs to that person and not to me, you
mm-hmm.
see. But the minute I hear it, it's my thought. It slits mm-hmm. through that machine,
right,
just as if I had produced it, right?
Right.
And in fact, I often ask other people to say nice things, or I sort of indicate to them that they ought to be saying nice things, so that can slip through the machine and pleasantly stimulate the body, right? So now, therefore, then along comes somebody who says things that are not nice, and it stimulates the body in an unpleasant way, right? And then I say, I have a problem. How can I separate these pleasant stimulations from the unpleasant ones? Because I can't, right?
Right?
But then I try somehow, by being not straight about it, to separate it, right? To act mm-hmm. To try to relieve the tension by saying all sorts of things, saying, that person is jealous of me, or
right.
he wants, and so on. It doesn't count what he says, and so on. You see, so there's a whole process of self-deception. Now,
right.
Now, you see, that's all happening with fear or with anger or jealousy or rage or confrontation, right?
Yeah.
And that, as long as that goes on, really we can't make it proceed any further, really. We can talk endlessly about all sorts of subjects and it will all go into this mill and get chewed up, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now, therefore, we're saying any example is a good one. You see, as an individual, you can look at fear or rage or whatever, or jealousy, or whatever it is, if you can manage to do it, and you'll be all right. You see, you can see through this. In the group, we can look through the problems that arise in the group, such as confrontation. It's the same mechanism. See, somebody has, you have had an assumption, I don't know about what, saying, what was the one we were working on?
I think you were going to say that seeing that mechanism, the machine, as well as formation of that anger or whatever is very important. When you see that process, causality, that serves the purpose rather than dividing good and bad feelings. Am I right?
Yeah, I'm saying, but it's very, you see, so if we can actually see that at work, but to see that at work, we not only have to see the good and bad feelings, we must see the thoughts with which they are connected. It's only in the connection that you see the key point, you see. If you see the good and bad feelings by themselves, the body is assuming, the mind is assuming that they are originating in the body, and you've got to, you know, fix it. If you see only the thought, then you don't see that they're producing good and bad feelings, right? You have to see that one is indissolubly connected with the other, right? But the whole concealment mechanism is to prevent you from seeing that. The whole notion of the ego is to prevent that from being seen. The ego would vanish if that were seen, right? The ego as we know it, right? Because the ego is supported by that mechanism of not seeing this point. Do you see what I'm driving at then?
No, can you make that?
You see, there may be a true self, who knows, right? But we have a kind of false self, right? Which we call for convenience, calling the ego. Now, what is a false self, you see? What could it mean, you see? Something untrue is going on. You see, I'm saying that in this mechanism between thought and feeling, you could see it. You see that thought stirs up feelings, right? It's untrue. That connection between them is concealed. We're not aware that thought does stir up feelings. You have a thought, a minute later you have a feeling, you don't know that the thought has stirred it up. Huh?
Mm-hmm. But one moment, I mean, I don't know if this is relevant, but is it not also possible that the body itself would generate feelings?
So? Yes, that would be real feelings. The most elementary is to say you feel good or you have a toothache or whatever. You may have very subtle feelings and they may be very important. But the difficulty is they're confused with these feelings that are mechanically stirred up from thought.
Are you saying that the ego is the thoughts about ourselves that create the good feelings?
Yes. That whole process is the ego.
The whole process, even the thoughts that create
the
thought,
yeah, because without the thought it wouldn't work, you see. And then
I'm saying, is it the thought that creates the bad feelings and the thought that creates the good
feelings?
That's right.
That's the ego. The ego is supported by the concealment process. None of this would work, would have any attraction whatsoever, if the connection between thought and feeling were not concealed. Mm-hmm. You see, if you know that you are stirring up good feelings by thinking I am a very fine person, it will have very little satisfaction in that, right? Mm-hmm. You know.
And seeing that causal process is the solution. It brings up the solution to the problem.
Yes, but seeing it in actuality, not just abstractly, but seeing it as the tensions are there, seeing the tension which is compelling, urging thought to distort, right?
Yes.
It happens to one person of these two, okay, then the other person remains the same.
No, but I think this is the point about the dialogue. If we really do it right, it's happening to both at the same time. You see, this is a key point, that my thought is your thought. You see, it's everybody's thought. In this dialogue, whatever is happening is felt by everybody and seen by everybody if we're really alert, right? Now, I'm saying that when that whole operation of the thought process and the feelings takes place in everybody, it doesn't belong to anybody. It's like the virus. Once it's in you, you are the one who's reproducing it. So this virus enters everybody, right? Everybody, some people, you know, are not deeply affected by it, you know, and they may sort of see what it means, and then they can come in to sort of say things that help. But then the two people confronting each other, each one is undergoing the same process. So in this intense communication, it is possible for both people to see it together. You see that it's really one process. Everything is both public and private at the same time. Is that clear what I mean? That the thing, not only the thoughts, but the feelings are publicly displayed in the attitude of the body and the way the voice goes and so on, right? And everybody feels them to one degree or another. And everybody can, in principle, if he's alert, will see what the thought is behind it, right?
Good example would be when we all laugh together.
Yeah, that's right. That shows that everybody saw the point, right? And everybody felt tension, and everybody relieved it, right? So, you see, that's this assumption of separation we're questioning now, saying, are we all that separate, you see? I mean, in the mind. They say the body is separate, but is the mind really separate? Whatever we mean by the word mind, I mean, just using it in the colloquial sense, right? Is the thought process, is the significance process separate between us, right? You know, or isn't it one common flow of meaning, which we call dialogue, which gets broken up into a lot of separate polarized meanings?
What can you explain? When we were first talking about meaning, it seemed to me that we invent these meanings because we are separate.
It's the other way around. That our separation comes because the culture has produced these meanings over thousands of years, you know, millions maybe. The mind develops into separate minds. You see, I like to give this analogy again to the ballet dance, which we may have them all functioning from a common pool of meaning. Now we can imagine each one breaks into two groups and each one starts to do an independent dance. Then it could break up, each one could break up again and again, till each individual was doing his own thing, right? And you see, that's the sort of picture that it's possible to have a common pool of meaning and being in this group, or it's possible to break up into two polarized groups, or four, or five, or whatever, or even or more. So common mind is a common meaning. That meaning is action and being. And if we went to the cosmic level, just simply to raise that question, we could ask a question that's just in the mind. Is there a cosmic meaning? Is the same as to say, is there a cosmic mind, right? That is there a cosmic meaning which is active in the sense that our own group meaning or individual meaning is active, right? We can't answer that in just two words, but it shows the whole connection. But if we don't get the individual and group meaning clear, I think our mind will not be orderly enough to really be sensitive to the cosmic meaning.
So are you saying at least for some time there is cosmic meaning?
There may be time from time to time. And as our mind becomes more orderly and clear and sensitive, then the cosmic meaning comes into it more, you see. Now, but if it's all broken up into conflict inside and between us, then it won't.
Right now you don't think that it is continuous?
Well, it may. See, we would have to speculate about that. You see, I would like to say this is merely a proposal,
yes, I know.
Which we could explore, which I think is reasonable. And but it is very important to have the individual meaning and the group meaning fairly orderly.
Yes.
And therefore, in that cosmic meaning there can arise this creativity, right? Because the mind is sensitive, the individual and group mind is sensitive and free, capable of free play to respond to the cosmic meaning.
The free play is creativity.
The free play is the condition for is the necessity for creativity. That if we say creativity would originate from a creative intelligence, but the mind must be free to play, to respond, right? If it's rigid, has rigid necessity, non-yielding, then it can't, and it will become more like an inanimate object, which does not respond, right? So the more rigid we are, the more we become like machines and inanimate objects, and the less sensitive and so on.
Like resonance.
Yeah. So therefore, all this work is all one. You see that the individual mind, the sociocultural mind, and the cosmic mind, it's all different aspects of one. And if I'd like to make a sort of a thing that if we say there are three dimensions, you see, if you take a figure, a line is in one dimension, you see a plane is in two and the solid is in three. Now, there might be some objects which have so little of the third dimension, they're rather flat, you see. And some objects would get so narrow, they become almost linear. So, you see, if the mind could then get stuck either being flat or linear, very restricted, you see, but it could open up into other dimensions, right? But if we don't bring in all of these dimensions, we will either be flat or linear.
I would like to, when you're just talking about free play, some perception occurred to me, which is another way of putting free play is a movement without motive.
That's the same thing. You see, it's a motive that restricts the play, right?
Motive is going from here to there.
But it's also unyielding. You see, it restricts, right?
It's a resistance.
Yeah.
It's resistance. I mean, play would be the flow that is the essence of it.
Yeah, it's all similar, you see. So there's similar ways of putting it now. But we come back that I think that the sociocultural dimension has not been given proper attention, generally speaking. That we have sort of taken for granted that all these tensions are going to arise when people try to talk to each other, and that we merely somehow have to deal with them. You see, the reason why I have emphasized dialogue is that it really has gotten very little attention thus far. And that is a crucial point, that if one of the dimensions of the human being is not is restricted, then that's not enough, right?
What are some examples of the first and the last that has been emphasized?
Well, the individual dimension, for example, we can discuss. If you get angry, you can look into your own disorder, you see, by being aware of it, right? By observing it and so on. You see, that has been discussed, in many ways. The cosmic has been discussed in many ways, you see. But You see, I don't think that a lot of attention has been given to the socio-cultural dimension, that we really have to, it's not enough just to talk about it, we have got to do something about it, right? We can only, as an individual, you can see where you are producing disorder in relationship as you watch the tension of the body when it comes up in relationship, right? Now, but then if you do that as an individual and then suddenly in the, you get into a discussion and you can't do it, you see if you get into a group and you find it runs away, then it's not good enough, right? You see that a different order of problem arises when there's a large group where all sorts of sociocultural assumptions become operative, which are not very strong when one or two people are around. And therefore, you find that people can be carried away into this situation, and there, it not only prevents our civilization from working, but it will prevent us from being open to all the dimensions. Right?
Saying if there may be a special value in people coming together in groups of some number,
yeah,
and seeing if the things
in the same way that there's value as an individual in looking at these things and being aware of, you see, the problem is very similar when there's confrontation. You have this tension in the body, you are not aware of how it's connected with how you think or how the other, you see, the new dimension is you're not aware of how it's connected with what the other person is thinking, right? You may say, okay, I'll look at my thoughts, but it's the other person's thoughts that is producing the tension too, because they're immediately your thoughts, right?
That is where the problem is.
Why?
Always I tend to think that is where the problem
yes,
is.
Yes, but the other person and me are the same in this context, you see.
Not on my side, but problem is there.
Yes, but I project it out and say he's making trouble for me. But in fact, he becomes me and I become two people making trouble for myself, right?
Isn't this rooted in the point you made yesterday about what we are as an individual to a large extent is idiosyncrasies, which come from really a common pool. So maybe this is connected to the generative source, at least at the sociocultural level.
Yes, yeah, that's so that we are having this common pool. We look to the common pool for all sorts of thoughts to comfort us. And when thoughts come around which make us uncomfortable, we have a problem, right? We say, how can we get rid of those and keep these? But the machine takes both, right? There's no way out of it, right? You have set up a machine to turn those thoughts into good feelings, but it will turn the opposite thoughts into bad feelings.
Which will then try to turn the bad feelings into good feelings.
It'll try, but then that'll be a hopeless confusion, right?
So are you saying the thing to do is then go a step further and ask why the other person feels that way? Try and feel. See where he's coming from.
That's a good point, yes. That you then begin to say not only where he's coming from, but can I feel the way the other, I'm actually feeling where the other person is feeling, but I'm saying it's him that's feeling it and not me, right? But in fact, all the feelings that I feel are going on in me, right? So
you're saying then, can I become the other person?
Yes, can I let the other person's feelings unfold in me with, in the same way suspending it as I suspend my own, right?
If you are concentrating on what the other person is thinking and feeling, then you must automatically suspend your own.
Yeah.
Well, your energy is then being expended in that direction rather than inward.
Yes, it goes together. You suspend your own and you're also letting the other person's feelings come in, but suspending those too. You see, not letting them go all the way. And then you can say, here I'm holding two sets of thoughts and feelings together in tension. And out of that tension, something creative can arise.
We've institutionalized all this stuff in society through, I mean, what is sin but holding two different separate concepts in your mind at the same time? What is guilt? I mean, we've taken all this simple thing you're talking about and made it the structure of society.
Well, because because the reason is that we have concealed this what's going on, do you see? The mind conceals the fact that the thought and the feeling are part of one process, right? And then says, I've got to produce the good thoughts, I've tried to separate the good thoughts from the good feelings from the bad ones, and the good thoughts from the bad ones. But you see, once this mechanism exists, they cannot be separated. See, therefore, that's why we have to say, don't judge, right? You see, the minute you judge this thought is good and that thought is bad, you're lost.
Is that empathy?
What?
Is that empathy, what you just heard?
It would be a kind of empathy, yes, that's another word for it. You see, that the... you can see the difficulty in this empathy whenever you are direct, you feel yourself to be attacked, right? It's easy to be empathetic when, you know, somebody agrees with you, or you know, or else you're sorry for the person or something. But if somebody says something that threatens you, then that's a much more serious...
Could you restate that again? This is what? A key thing you're saying, and how you filter out or don't filter out, but you... The bad does not get through to make you react in this emotional...
Well, you see, essentially you have to say the good also doesn't make you react, you see.
Yes.
You see, but people don't want to give it... One doesn't want to give that up. You say, one wants to say, I want the good reactions to continue, but get rid of the bad ones. That's the assumption. But see, the mechanism is such that once you set it up to produce the good reactions, it cannot avoid producing the bad reactions. Therefore, the mechanism must be dismantled. Yeah, they can be very deceptive, you see.
The question arises here. Now, listening to Krishnamurti, I thought that this sort of thing can happen at the end of thought, ending of thought. But here, you are explaining it is in the thought process still.
Yes, you see, this is a matter of bringing order into life, right? Into ordinary life. See, that I think what he says, which sort of goes over a great deal of ground at once, is to bring order into your daily life is really the first step, right? But then, without that order in your daily life, you really can't see these other things. Now, but this order I'm suggesting has to be in our communication as well, in large groups too, you see. And especially if you're going to set up groups to do anything. Yeah. And see, so, but the same questions are arising. Essentially, the question of the observer and the observed is arising, the one I've described. Right? That, you see, the observer, that there's the assumption that the mind is observing the feelings or the thoughts alternatively, and but that the observer is independent of all that is being observed. Is that as it is in looking at the chair? But it is a false assumption, not merely incorrect, but false. Untrue, you see. And the assumption is that but in fact, if the observed happens to be all these feelings, whether good or bad, the thought process is profoundly affected by them to be untrue and self-deceptive. If the feeling is good, then the thought process wants to hold it, and it will distort everything to defend the good feeling. If the feeling is bad, it will defend it and by getting rid of it or whatever. But so the point is that the observer is the observed. You see, whatever you call the observer is in fact controlled by the observed.
With the observer and the observed, the judgment itself?
Yeah, the judgment is the observer, but the judgment is also the observed, because the judgment is what has produced the very thing.
It's it's the like and dislike is the observer and the observed itself, too, isn't it?
Yes, but the observer as judgment produces the whole tension of the body, which could then become, for the moment, the observed. But that observed is affecting the next judgment, right? In a false way. And it gets lost in, you know, and it contains all this concealment and so on. You see, there's a long, you could go into why this has all developed and so on, and make some reasonable speculations, but we really, of course, the time is coming to finish, but let's leave that go and just say the fact is that this has happened. This has come about over thousands or hundreds of thousands of years. And this is the principal, not only problem of human society, but it's also the principal thing which prevents life from having meaning. Right? See, if all this is going on, what could life mean? You see, you're lost in something false. You know, what is false and untrue can have no meaning, right?
Because there's no being.
What?
There's no being in.
There's no, if what has no meaning has no being, right? Or,
what is implied in all this, then, is that if this dialogue takes place, then this dismantling you're speaking of.
Yeah, both individual. I want to say that if we would work on both individually and together, it would become far more effective, you see. If you were watching, say, if we were to meet, let's say, once a week, just for the sake of discussion, but meanwhile you were watching this thing in your particular relationships, and then we came together, you see, the combination of the individual and the sociocultural would have a very powerful effect.
Isn't that something that's going on right now, in the mm-hmm. sense that if, as an individual, we're paying attention mm-hmm. to the process, but not necessarily commenting on it in a personal way.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
Because that seems to spoil something.
Yes.
So what we're actually focusing on is this larger context, at the same time focusing on the other. It's like that occurring.
Yes, I see, in this context, if there is a confrontation, each one of us can feel the tension of that confrontation and understand that what's going on in the confrontation is essentially the same, though perhaps more intense.
Do you think it's there's some value in joining a group to continue something like this?
Well, yes, in principle there should be. You see, now that raises the question, you see, of how to do it, though, you see. And I think that this would require somebody to not exactly lead it, but to get it started.
Would this person have to have some kind of unusual skill?
No, not unusual, but at least he should understand the principles and have some skill, you see, that eventually that person, he should work in such a way as to work himself out of a job, right? That, to make himself unnecessary, right? Mm-hmm. But to try not to lead too much, but to sort of use more hints and you know, suggestions and so on. Most of the energy being supplied by the people. He would take part on the same basis for the most part as others, right? Now, I think that I don't think it could get started without that. You see, that's my opinion. I mean, carefully considered. I think it would be valuable if it could be done. But of course, you may find that you sort of founder on, you know, all these problems. You know,
if several people get some sense of this, then all the burden isn't on one person.
Yeah.
And they back him up, and that thing of becoming a leader and so on doesn't arise.
You might use even several people might try to take this role. You see, it doesn't have to be one. I think that. It's like saying it's an art, and if somebody has some sort of skill or ability in this art, he can help get things started, you see. But the others are learning the art, and therefore eventually that person becomes unnecessary in that special role, right, for that group of people.
Could I ask a question? There are a lot of us who know people that are going to come in 2 more weeks. Would you have any suggestions about our communication with those people?
Well, I don't know.
All
these things all go differently. The next one may go very differently.
So they could have no expectation?
No. You see, the next one may take a very different form. You know, for all we know, we might discuss order and creativity.
It might contaminate the process. Contaminate the process. I mean,
yeah.
The virus might start to work on them.
Yeah, it's best to say nothing, I think, that, you know, we really don't know how it should go, you know.
We do hope that you'll come back and do this again. Maybe you'll be doing it next time.
Yeah, I mean, that would be many others should be doing it. Well, you want to say something?
The end.
The name.